Here I am. Good morning, everybody. We're about to open up the line. So if you have a question for Professor Kaku, that's what we're here for. It's quite a night. And ladies and gentlemen, it's quite a book. Physics of the Impossible. And it's, I don't know, about to be number 12 on the bestseller list nationally. And it doesn't surprise me, although Dr. Kaku frequently does. We'll be right back. Professor, I see you have a chapter on extraterrestrials and UFOs.
Mm-hmm, I sure do.
In that, you tackle SETI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may not know a thing about this, but just a few weeks ago, there was a fascinating story that did appear on CNN and elsewhere for a short time in which they claimed that SETI had received a signal or some signal that they considered might be extraterrestrial. And their comment was that it was extremely complex and would take a long time, perhaps years, to understand. And that story just sort of died. Now, you have to wonder about something like that. And had you heard that story first?
No, but I think we're going to get more stories like that because Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire, has donated about $25 million to pump funds and energy into the SETI project by creating a battery of radio telescopes in Hat Creek, north of San Francisco, which could open up a new era for SETI. You know, we've only scanned about 1,000 stars or so with any degree of accuracy.
Right.
And that's puny. I mean, within our own galaxy, there's 100 billion stars. And we've only scanned about 1,000 stars with any kind of credibility. This allows us to scan 1,000 times more stars, having this sudden influx of money. And then Kepler goes up in orbit later this year. That'll find Earth-like twins in outer space. We're going to have an existential shock knowing that up to 600 Earth-like twins will be picked up by the Kepler satellite. Mm-hmm. And when we see the familiar constellations at night, we're going to have this epiphany, realizing that somebody could be looking back at us from the familiar constellations.
Yes, indeed.
And that's going to focus the SETI project. You know, once we identify which planet, which star has an Earth-like planet going around them, then we can focus our SETI project with all our battery radio telescopes, compliments of Paul Allen, and perhaps really pick up something, you know? So I'm a little bit more optimistic now that money is being pumped into it and Kepler is going to going up in orbit. So I think we're going to get more of these things. Now, just to be fair, just because you pick up a signal doesn't mean that it's real. There was a signal called the WOW signal years ago.
Oh, yes.
We thought the WOW signal was real, but other people have looked at it and said, well, it could be static, you know. So we're going to have to make sure that this is not static rather than a real signal, not just static. But I think the big story is that we're going to be able to focus our attention on a handful of stars and have a battery, a radio telescope, to eavesdrop on conversations with these aliens. And when that happens, by the way, I think we should not try to make contact with them. We don't know their intentions.
Right.
And I think we should just listen rather than trying to send things to them and say, here we are, when we don't know what their intentions are.
Is it your feeling that life is probably common?
I think so. I think microbial life is fairly common throughout the galaxy, you know, germs and pond scum.
Sure.
Intelligent life is probably rare because, you know, the dinosaurs existed for 200 million years or so, and that we have not a single species of intelligent dinosaurs, and they were around for a long time. So I think intelligence is difficult to get off the ground, but nonetheless, there are so many stars in the galaxies and so many galaxies out there. You know, we can track about 100 billion galaxies, each one having 100 billion stars. So the total number of stars in the visible universe is 100 billion times 100 billion.
So there's probably intelligent life.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got to let some of the audience ask questions, so let's do exactly that. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Professor Kaku. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. I had a question because you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the program that some of these theories you wrote about in your book came from Star Trek, or Star Trek came from them, or something like that, in one form or another?
Well, Gene Roddenberry stole many of these ideas from physics, like antimatter engines, warp drive, and stuff like that. Okay. He was very good at stealing things from physics. not that we care.
I don't think he meant to steal them for a gain. He just kind of stole them to put them out there so people would pick this up and develop them more.
Yeah, so I have no hard feelings at all. I think it was a good thing. He popularized antimatter, popularized the concept of warping space and time. That was a good thing.
Okay, a couple questions. Has there ever been any type of theory called the Dyson sphere?
Yeah, that's for a Type 2 civilization.
Okay, could that actually happen, where you would encapsulate an entire galaxy into a sphere?
Well, a Type 1 civilization harnesses the power of an entire planet. You know, they control the weather, they control volcanoes. We're about 100 years from being Type 1. You mentioned Type 2, that is stellar, like the Federation of Planets with the Enterprise. That's a typical Type 2 civilization. Type 3 civilization would be galactic, like the Empire of Star Wars or the Borg of Star Trek. Galactic civilizations would be Type 3. The Dyson Sphere is a sphere that surrounds a star that allows you to use all the energy of a star. And that would be a Type 2 civilization, because they can manipulate stars. They are immortal, by the way. Nothing known to science can destroy a Type 2 civilization. Comets can be deflected. Ice ages can be delayed. Even the death of their mother's star is not catastrophic for Type 2. They can either reignite their star or move their planet or simply leave.
Okay.
So that's the Dyson sphere. In fact, Dyson realized the Type 2 classification. The Type 2 classification comes from Nikolai Kardashev of the former Soviet Union. So Dyson used the Kardashev classification to say, what would a Type 2 civilization look like? And then he created the Dyson sphere. Which became a Star Trek episode, by the way.
Yeah, it was. That's where I was thinking of it, because you mentioned transporters, and I got all stuck in this thought about Scotty stuck in a transporter for several years, if you remember that episode.
Right. So Star Trek is a typical Federation of Planets is a Type 2 civilization.
Okay. All right, caller. Thank you very much. Force fields, Professor. Ronald Reagan would have loved this one. Would it be possible one day to protect a country, America, for example, and have some sort of field that literally would protect us against something entering from space, something re-entering that had been fired from another country or whatever?
Well, we have something called plasma windows that mimic the force fields found in Star Trek. They use force fields to separate the air inside the Enterprise from the vacuum of outer space.
Uh-huh.
That saves money, so they don't have to have expensive airlocks. That costs money for Paramount Studios to put in airlocks everywhere. So with plasma windows, that is a sheet of hot gas, we can actually do that now. We can actually, on a small scale, create a partial vacuum on the Earth and surround the vacuum with a plasma shield. And so we can then manipulate air on one hand at atmospheric pressure and a vacuum on the other hand. That's why it was created. You can then reinforce it. For example, with carbon nanotubes, with nanotechnology, you can have a crisscross, a fishnet, consisting of carbon nanotubes. It would be invisible. And that would also help to reinforce this shield. And then you could even have crisscrossing laser beams to incinerate anything that goes through.
Wow.
So I think a combination of three things, a plasma window, which is a sheet of hot gas, a fishnet of carbon nanotubes, and a crisscross of high-power laser beams, that would look very similar to a force field.
Boy, talk about destabilizing. All right, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Kaku. Good morning.
Good morning. First, I had a comment and a question. Comment first, it's a privilege to speak with you, Art, and Michio Kaku.
Thank you.
My question is, Professor, speaking of the physics as impossibilities, do you believe that there are anomalies out in the universe that we can't sense with our five senses, that we cannot detect with our sophisticated instruments or technology? Like in the analogy of a dog, they can't, no matter how hard they try to grasp the concept of a black hole, they can never fathom what a black hole truly is. Even though they can't, you know, acknowledge a black hole, it doesn't mean that the black hole doesn't exist in nature or in the universe. So my question to you is, do you believe that there are anomalies out in the universe that, you know, just because we can't sense them or consciously acknowledge them, that they're not there?
Well, one anomaly is attracting a lot of attention just in the last month. That's the Pioneer anomaly. We've known for quite a while that the Pioneer and the Voyager escaping the gravitational field of the sun are not behaving the way Isaac Newton said an object should behave. But most physicists said, nah, it's a solar wind, some kind of disturbance, right? Well, and this created quite a shock. Scientists then reanalyzed satellites that went around the Earth in a slingshot effect, like the Cassini probe and Galileo. We've used the slingshot effect around the Earth to catapult our space probes out to Saturn. We analyzed them, and we found that there was another anomaly, that of several space probes that whipped around the planet Earth on their way to Jupiter, the Newton's laws of motion were slightly wrong. Now, this is a shock, because we have no great solar wind pushing the Earth that's measurable. And it should have been a perfect correspondence with Newton's laws of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have another anomaly. So all of a sudden, this Pioneer anomaly, which we kind of like laughed at for a while, we're not laughing at anymore. We have a problem now.
I was wondering when the laughter on that subject would stop. Professor, how much of a difference is there between what should have been and what we now know to be true?
Well, when you look at these satellites, I think they analyzed five satellites that whipped around the Earth. The difference is small. You're talking about one part in maybe a million, one part in 10 million.
Right.
However, Newton's laws of gravity are easily good to one part in like almost a billion. So we're off by a factor of 1,000 or so. So this is embarrassing. And already now, physicists are beginning to write papers trying to explain the Pioneer anomaly, which is bigger than we thought. This is something that we cannot sense because, of course, gravity is invisible. There's no appreciable solar wind that could blow, you know, these satellites adrift. So maybe there's something that we don't know. This anomaly, that the Pioneer anomaly, may not just be for deep space. It may be for the Earth as well.
But with respect to Pioneer, there is beginning to be quite a chasm, quite a difference, isn't there?
Yeah, not just one part in 10 million, but it's rather sizable now. So, and again, you could always dismiss it as a solar wind or some kind of extra solar activity from another star or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's happening right near the Earth, so you can't dismiss it anymore. And computer analysis shows there's something there. So
we're going to have to come up with some other theory.
Some other theory, yeah. Maybe some of your listeners can come up with something to explain this anomaly.
And perhaps Joel in Miami. You're on the air with Dr. Kaku. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Bell. My gosh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I haven't been on in 15 years except for three times, and suddenly I managed. I'd say almost as if this is time to do and make my breakthrough here, because I've been into physics for 40 years. I want to get my head around the many worlds interpretation, but it's not for an explanation, because I've gone through this 1,000 times a thousand times. And unfortunately, every time I make a choice like that, I guess I'm making another universe. I have a question. If 7 billion people are on this planet and each of them make 1,000 choices a day, we're talking a trillion new universes, and multiply that out every day, you can see what I'm saying. And animals make choices. They make choices. Are animals involved in this probabilistic conundrum? And worst of all, if the universe is as the Eastern teachings tell us, and I deal with that a lot, I go back to the Eastern teachings and the Western teachings, if it's alive, if it's a living being, I really don't even want to contemplate creating the physical body of a universal being 1,000 times a day. I mean, how do I get, what is really going on here? Is it an external event, or in some way an internalized series of universes? I don't know. But I need some kind of, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. First of all, the quantum theory is the most successful theory known to science. It's tested to one part in 10 billion. It makes laser beams possible, electronics, satellites, the internet. You're listening to my voice, compliments of the quantum theory, because transistors and all of electronics use the quantum theory. The problem is, as you correctly pointed out, is based on a foundation of sand, because we have this problem of many worlds. That is, the universe keeps splitting into different universes, not just with humans, not just with animals, but every cosmic ray, every incident, every meteor could conceivably create new universes. Now, this goes back to the cat problem. The Schrodinger cat problem is perhaps the deepest paradox in all of physics. This is the number one paradox. If I have a cat in a box and the cat is connected to a gun and the gun is connected to uranium, we know that uranium is a quantum object. That's why we have atomic bombs. So we have to add the wave function of uranium which fired and add the wave function of uranium which didn't fire. But the uranium is connected to a gun and the gun is connected to a cat. So the question is the cat dead or alive? Well, we don't know. You have to add the wave function of a dead cat to the wave function of a live cat. The cat is neither dead nor alive. Now, that may sound stupid, but that's how we describe electrons.
Well, it sounds more complicated. The way I remember, it was just a cat in a box. Now you've got a gun and uranium in there.
Yeah, just to make it even more difficult. So uranium is obviously a quantum device. That's how we describe hydrogen bombs. Otherwise, hydrogen bombs don't work. But if a uranium is connected to a gun, gun's connected to a cat, that means the cat is neither dead nor alive. Now, how do you resolve this paradox? The simplest is many worlds. In one universe, the cat is dead, the uranium fired. In the other universe, the cat is alive. The universe split into two universes. Now, no matter how bizarre that sounds, it works. That's how we describe quantum computers. That's how we describe transistors. That's how we describe laser beams, okay? Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, but I think you've complicated the point that PETA is going to get involved. I mean, the cat's now in there with a gun and uranium. My God.
So the question is, if our universe keeps on splitting apart, then Elvis Presley could be alive in one universe. Perhaps in those other universes, you have brothers and sisters that don't exist in our universe.
You've mentioned Elvis now a number of times.
It's like Twilight Zone. And, you know, as the person correctly pointed out, if there's 6-7 billion people on the planet Earth, then each of them are splitting apart. You know, your mind starts to swim after a while.
Isn't it possible, then, that the concept of death intertwines with this?
Well, yeah. I mean, in another universe, your parents who passed away are still alive. Or maybe in another universe, you are dead. And in this universe, you're still alive.
So yes, but perhaps as long as you're alive in one universe or the other, life continues, and death as we know it really doesn't exist?
In some universes you can die, but in other universes you could still survive. For example, if a cosmic ray goes through Hitler's mother and Hitler's mother had a miscarriage, one quantum event separates us from a universe where 50 million people didn't have to die during World War II. But they did die in our universe. So in our universe, we have 50 million less people having children.
Doesn't all this eventually start to give you a quantum headache?
Yeah, but believe it or not, Nobel laureates subscribe to this theory. This is now the dominant theory in my field, theoretical physics. And like I said, its proven utility is that we can describe laser beams this way, quantum computers. In fact, quantum computers compute in parallel universes. And one day, your laptop will have a quantum computer in it, and your laptop will be computing in alternate universes.
So then it's possible that when I go to Google one day on this new computer, it will go to another universe for the response.
That's right. You will access other universes, and that's what quantum computing is all about, computing
and
in other universes.
On that note, we'll be right back. Physics of the impossible, and it's taken off at near light speed, if not a bit better. Dr. Michio Kaku is my guest, and in a moment we'll ask him why this particular book has taken off in a way that one might not have imagined. Be right back. It'd be interesting to collect your feelings, Professor, on, you know, you've had many very popular books, but this one has clearly taken off at near light speed. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's kind of a mystery. The book has only been out 2 weeks, and last week it was number 18, and this next week is it'll hit 12 on the New York Times bestseller list. I think that all of us, when we go to the movies and see the Hollywood blockbusters like Star Wars and Terminator and E.T., they're all related to science fiction, and you're thrilled with the special effects. But then later, you have this empty feeling that, well, is any of it true? Was it all just a fairy tale? Are we all suckers for Hollywood scriptwriters' fevered imagination? And there's no book. There's no book that addresses whether or not these things are possible, because most physicists, quite frankly, are too embarrassed to talk about starships and extraterrestrial intelligence and UFOs. And personally, I get a little irritated when the topic of UFOs come up, and my fellow physicists laugh, snicker, their eyes roll up to the sky.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, and, you know, they say that the distance between stars is so great that UFOs can't possibly negotiate these distances. But that assumes that aliens are just type 1 civilizations, maybe 100, 200 years ahead of us. But if they're 1,000 years ahead of us, if they're type 2, if they're type 3, and they're like 100,000 years more advanced than us, then it may be child's play for them to negotiate the vast distances of our galaxy.
Which is as likely as not, right?
Right. And so that's why I decided to rank these impossibilities, just to show you that most of what we consider impossible is impossible just for us.
Well, clearly, the American public, or the world's public, agrees with you. And that's probably why the book's going flying off the shelves. But what about your colleagues, or is it too early?
Oh, well, you know, in the old days, if you wrote a book that talked about these things, your fellow physicists would kind of snicker a bit, because that's talking to the unwashed masses. That's why it's talking to the ignorant. Well, you know, the ignorant people pay taxes, and they're the ones that fund research. And we physicists have to get used to the fact the Cold War is over, and we can't expect Congress to fund super colliders anymore. They want to know what money they're going to get, what value they're going to get for their money. And so now physicists actually write books. Stephen Hawking, of course, has written monster bestsellers. And other physicists are saying, yeah, well, maybe we too should engage the public, because otherwise they may cut off our funding.
And
we can't stay in the ivory tower anymore. So my friends don't snicker anymore when I write books, and they say, well, why should a research physicist dabble with the unwashed masses, right?
Sure.
Well, the unwashed masses pay our paycheck.
Uh-huh. I believe the Wall Street Journal says one of the best popular accounts of higher physics. Let's go east of the Rockies to Russ in Toronto.
Good morning, Art. And
hi.
Good morning, Professor Kaku.
Mm-hmm.
Authors Jerome Corsi and Craig Smith, in a work titled Black Gold Stranglehold, The Myth of Scarcity and the Politics of Oil, have challenged the oil industry's claim that the oil on planet Earth is fossil fuel based, and that there is a peak period beyond which the cost for oil will be great because we'll be running out of this finite resource. But these have challenged that and have said that this is abiotic, a hyphen biotic, not biotic, and have pointed to Saturn and its moon Titan that is comprised, it is said, of seas of oil. The question there is that evidence of an abiotic process or support for the oil industry's position? And secondly, will the West at least have to legislate against the use of food grains like wheat and corn for ethanol and flex fuels? Because notables like Robert Zubrin, author of Energy Victory, a nuclear engineer, suggests that there are a number of other natural processes, substances, products from which we can get our ethanol and flex fuels, and we shouldn't be using our food grains to get it. And I'll receive your answers off air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you introduced a lot of concepts. First of all, Titan is a moon of Saturn. It's the only moon that has an appreciable atmosphere. It looks like a fuzzy tennis ball from outer space. We've analyzed the atmosphere, and we were a little bit surprised to find large quantities of methane and ethane. Methane, of course, you use in your stove, and it ignites. Titan will not ignite because it has no oxygen in the atmosphere to combust with the methane. But it does show you that in outer space, methane, ethane, different kinds of very simple organic-type molecules can, in fact, exist. But that's Titan, and that's the moon of Saturn. On the Earth, okay, on the Earth now, most of the methane that we get comes from decay of plant life that died thousands of years ago. For example, Siberia is beginning to thaw out now, And methane gas is about 20 times worse than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. And as Siberia begins to thaw out because of global warming, it could release a huge amount of methane into the atmosphere, which will accelerate global warming and cause a vicious cycle to occur, which could definitely cause a tremendous disruption of the atmosphere. Now, about supply of oil, there is something called Hubbert's Peak. Hubbert was a Shell oil engineer in the 1960s who predicted that we are more or less halfway through exhausting America's oil supply. Well, people laughed at him. They said this bell-shaped curve, and we are on top of the bell-shaped curve, is science fiction. Well, Hubbert was right. We now import oil. The United States passed Hubbert's peak in the 1960s. Now people are saying, is there a Hubbert's peak for the Earth? The entire amount of oil in the Earth today, we could be at the top of this bell-shaped curve. We may have already used up half of all the oil in the Earth, and we're going to go downhill from now, which means that oil is going to become very expensive. Now, even if you don't believe in Hubbert's peak, we're going to have to discover a new Saudi Arabia every 10 years to keep up with the demand of the Chinese and the Indians and the rising middle class. There's no way we're going to discover a new Saudi Arabia every 10 years. So I think we're going to have to get used to the fact that the age of oil is gradually going to come to a close, that we are hitting the top of Hubbert's peak, and it's going to be downhill in the coming decades.
And you feel a hydrogen economy is a plausible replacement?
Solar hydrogen, right? The energy would come from the sun, and we would then channel this energy through hydrogen. Hydrogen does not give you net energy. It allows you to transmit energy. And then hydrogen would then take you to your fuel tank. And so a solar hydrogen economy would become feasible in 10, 15 years because every year it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and oil gets more expensive. And as I said, when the two curves cross, when the rising oil prices crosses with the curve of falling solar hydrogen, that's the beginning of a solar hydrogen era.
Any idea how far we might be from that now based on the skyrocketing costs?
It would be 10 to 15 years ahead still. And meanwhile, the atmosphere is crumbling, and, you know, Chicken Little was right, maybe. But the two curves will cross in about 10, 15 years. And I just hope that in time to put the brakes on the rising temperature of the planet Earth. It's a race against time. That's what I'm trying to say.
That's what I worry about as well. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Professor Kaku. Hi. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. Go ahead.
My question for the professor is, in regards to black holes, I really don't. This is the first time I've ever been exposed to physics on this type of level, so bear with me if I got a headache over the gun and the cat and the bot. But I'm still worried about us, you know, channeling out our passport stuff. But black holes, they transport. I mean, they suck in whatever's around them, and what comes out the other end? Is it destroyed? Is it a whole matter again? Does it come back into shape? I mean, I remember when we Star Trek, for a point of reference, would transform somebody from point A to point B, they would take their molecules and put them back together again, right? Is that my understanding? Is that how that works?
More or less. That's a transporter, right, on Star Trek.
Okay, so the black holes, do they do the same thing, or do they shred it and what comes out is just destroyed?
Okay, well, it's a controversy. First of all, falling into a black hole is not very pleasant. Surrounding the black hole, there's a sphere called the event horizon. It's the point of no return. Once you pass the event horizon, it's like a Roche motel. You check in and never check out again. But then the question that you raise is, well, where do you go? Okay. This has split the physics community. Stephen Hawking said that you're lost forever. Information is lost forever. The Encyclopedia Britannica, thrown through the event horizon, this imaginary sphere, would gobble up the Encyclopedia Britannica and all is lost. String theory, which is what I do for a living, says no, that information is never lost. You would have an afterglow, a shockwave coming out of the black hole. And just 2 years ago, Stephen Hawking changed his mind and said, well, maybe you string theorists are right. He now believes that information is not lost. But then the question is, where did the Encyclopedia Britannica go when you throw it into a black hole?
Right.
Well, we used to think that the black hole had a center of a dot, and the dot was infinite density, and so you died. We don't believe in that anymore. because every black hole that we see in outer space is spinning rapidly, and it collapses not to a dot but to a ring of neutrons. Centrifugal force prevents the ring from collapsing under its own gravity. And the math, anyway, shows that if you fall through the ring, you wind up through a parallel universe. You wind up on the other side of forever. It's the looking glass of Alice, that you push your hand through this ring and your hand winds up on another universe. Now, the controversy is, how stable is this ring? We don't know how stable it is, but that's what the math seems to indicate. In which case, if you throw the encyclopedia into a black hole, maybe it winds up on another universe. We don't know.
Fine. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, caller, and take care. Let's go to Chicago. You're on the air, Hillary.
Hello, Art. Hello, Hi. Doctor. This is really a privilege. Art, I've got a comment for you. And for the doctor, I have two questions. The comment is, please have audio and visual in anybody taking care of your mother or your daughter or your family. I went through an abuse situation, and I am a nurse with my own mother. Also, I have the two questions. Doctor, first of all, you know those chips that they had put in the animals and in the people in Florida? And they're finding out now that there are three or four fast-spreading cancers that are occurring in some of the animals. What could be the cause of that? And also, you had mentioned about your friend having Lou Gehrig's disease. Now, if the brain can be rejuvenated, why cannot his brain or his cells be rejuvenated? And I'll leave that going.
Okay, right. The first question about the cancers in but Florida, what caused the cancers?
I don't know. I think she was suggesting that these RFID chips that they put in pets.
Oh, identification chips. Oh, okay. Well, that's conceivable. The chips that I mentioned that are placed in the brain, on top of the brain of a stroke victim, they're sterilized. They're very tiny, smaller than a penny, and allow people to communicate via laptop computers, even if you're totally paralyzed. But just remember that chips placed in pets, they're not going to be taken care of so delicately by the doctors, and so they have to be monitored. And so I wouldn't be surprised if you're going to have side effects as a consequence of putting chips in animals.
Yeah, I suppose any foreign body introduced could cause all kinds of problems.
Yeah, you'd be careful about that.
Professor, and Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, we believe that stem cell technology will allow you to regenerate part of the nervous system. There's a videotape, a very famous videotape, of a mouse with a damaged spinal cord. Mm-hmm. The mouse could only walk on two legs. The hind legs are useless. It just drags the hind legs with it. You inject stem cells into the spinal cord. They begin to strengthen where the spinal cord was damaged. And all of a sudden, these mice are beginning to walk on all four legs. Isn't it amazing? This is supposed to be a medical impossibility. And there it is, a videotape. And so we think that stem cells may allow nerves to regenerate, even though it was once thought that that was medically impossible.
Professor, is the stem cell controversy now moot, or is it continuing? In other words, I've heard that adult stem cells now are able to be used in a way that we thought only embryonic ones could be used.
Well, there have been many false alarms. Several groups in the past have announced that if you take an adult stem cell, which has already become an eye, an ear, a leg, or what have you, then you can revert it back to an embryonic stem cell, in which case it could become anything else that you wanted to. Most of them were false alarms. The recent one, however, is being looked at very carefully. The recent announcement was done by a reputable group, and we think we can reproduce it, in which case that may diffuse some of the controversy because you're not killing an embryo in order to extract the stem cells.
Exactly.
But I personally feel that stem cell technology will eventually give us a human body shop. We'll order human parts from the hospital. Right now, even without stem cells, we can grow cartilage, noses, ears, skin, bone, heart valves, blood vessels, and the first bladder from a woman's own stem cells, own cells. The first bladder was grown last year.
Wow.
And next is the liver. We will grow a liver from a mold from your own cells, probably within 5 years. And that's, of course, great news for alcoholics out there.
I was going to say, I'll drink to that. All right. To St. Louis and Scott, you're on with Dr. Kaku. Hi.
Hi, Art. Great to hear you again.
Thank you.
Professor Kaku, I know, I think I have a theory about why your book is doing so well. Mm-hmm. It's as your appearances on television, you explain the universe in a way that we can understand it.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I appreciate that. My little question is, as far as Voyager space probe, any probes we send into space, aren't we backtracking the Big Bang? So in a sense, we're time traveling then?
Well, when we send space probes into outer space, in some sense, they are time travelers. The faster you move, the slower time beats. And we measure that with our GPS system. Your GPS system would fail unless our satellites obeyed Einstein's theory, which allows you to go a little bit into the future the faster you go. Otherwise, your GPS system would be off, and the Pentagon could not fight wars. Pentagon generals had to be briefed on Einstein's theory because it's a small correction that you have to put into the GPS system or else they fail. So our space probes travel at very fast velocity. So we do have to factor in some of these time distortions or else our satellites don't function properly.
Okay, that explains it. I just thought it's kind of, we're going backwards. So I just thought that was a form of time travel. Into a specific time.
Yeah, well, these satellites actually go a little bit into the future. Astronauts, when they go for about a year in outer space, they're, you know, about a microsecond into the future. So that's traveling into the future via Einstein's special theory of relativity. We do that with our rocket ships every day. Going back into the past, that's the big one. Whether or not we can go into the past and change the past, that is a source of a lot of interest right now among physicists.
All right, very quickly, west of the Rockies to Dale in Las Vegas. Hi, Dale.
Right. Oh, hi, Art. This is for Mr. Professor Kaku.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you been sworn to secrecy? And also, assume that a top scientist should get top samples. Have you ever seen anything he thought was from Mac Brazel's farm?
Well, no. First of all, I'm a theoretician rather than an experimentalist. So I work with Einstein's theory. I work with the quantum theory. I work in a world of equations, which then allow us to explain what happens in the experimental world.
So you don't get sent saucer samples. But his other question, have you ever done work that required you to be sworn to secrecy?
I haven't. However, there is a group called JASN where my colleagues who are theoretical physicists, some of them Nobel laureates, are asked by the government to work in, black arts kinds of projects. And so these people definitely work for the Pentagon on the black arts that are practiced by DARPA, which consumes a lot of the finest minds of our scientific establishment on military projects. The Internet, for example, came out of that. The internet used to be called ARPANET. It was
Professor, we're out of time.
Wow.
That's it. Show's over. It's unbelievable. We'll do it again, my friend. Thank you so very much.
Okay. And, been a pleasure.
And good luck with Physics of the Impossible. You're not going to, well, you don't need luck. It's going at light speed. Good night.
Okay. Good night.